parliamentary system and the lobbying system in Parliament all work very, very closely with the arms industry.
Ministers' decision influenced when they were in office by future job prospects.
The system as it works right now is very prone to risk, and that's not good for the UK.
I got the minutes of 5 meetings that took place between BP and Shell and the British government in the 6 months leading up to the war.
Do you have your own weapons company? Or perhaps you're an oil tycoon? Do you want to know how to get government to do what you want? Well, if so, this is the film for you. In this program, we'll show you how to buy influence in Westminster in just 6 easy steps. Step 1. Amass an army of lobbyists.
Lobbying is the organised attempt by interests to try and influence policy or legislation, and it's an attempt by interests to go direct to those agencies to try and get a regulation changed or a new law enacted, rather than go through the normal democratic process, i.e. through the election process. So it's a way of circumventing democracy, really, in essence.
We're told we live in a democracy, but the people who vote for the MPs, the ordinary people of Britain, have no notion, most of them, that this goes on. They would be absolutely shocked if they went to Parliament and saw the amount of lobbying that goes on.
Its whole purpose is parasitic. They're living off the processes of democracy, and their whole role is to gain further advantages to those who are already advantaged. The privileged, the wealthy, the well-heeled, the powerful are the ones who gain generally from lobbying.
There are thousands of corporate lobbyists operating in Westminster every single day. And all around Parliament, there are hundreds of lobbying firms. Many of them conceal the identity of their clients, so you can push your agenda and overwhelm the country's democratic structures on the sly.
If you go to one of the main party conferences, you will see room after room of meeting rooms, which are sponsored and subsidised by a whole number of lobbying firms and companies, which essentially provide very nice amounts of food and drink and all this kind of thing, with the aim of promoting the interests of their company, with the aim of promoting objective debate or honest accounting.
It's very much about subterfuge, about getting a word here, putting a bit of pressure there, a bit of influence there, a promise, and that way decisions are nudged into existence.
The Ministry of Defence has got a very cosy relationship with the arms trade. In 2007, it revealed that it had dished out 38 security passes to BAE Systems employees. One of the lucky recipients was the company's chief lobbyist, Julian Scopes, whose pass gave him access to the top levels of the ministry, allowing him to lobby ministers and senior officials.
Lobbyists, whether they're in consultancies or working directly for the company itself, are trying to populate the information environment round about decision makers so that almost everything they hear, or the bulk of what they hear, is conducive to the corporations. There are a whole range around this building of think tanks, which are set up as sort of independent, quasi-independent organisations who just do some thinking and think up good policy ideas. Actually, they're almost entirely funded by the corporations or by very rich individuals. And that's another mechanism for the lobbyists to surround the minister. So if the minister hears from the chief executive of a company and hears from a lobbyist and hears at a social event and hears from a think tank all the same thing, it might all come from the same corporation, the minister might begin to think that this is a general opinion held in the population. And of course, usually it's very far from that.
Step 2, book a meeting. Once your lobbyists introduce you to the key decision makers, drop into the relevant ministry for a chat with top officials and tell them what's on your mind.
The oil companies don't need to lobby the British government. They might have a few meetings, either at the senior vice president level or at the chief executive level, together with either ministers or senior civil servants. These are kind of relatively informal chats where they just kind of say what they want and the government says, yes, of course, that's what we're thinking too. If we think back to the time of the Iraq War and the months leading up to it, the British government was completely insistent that it wasn't thinking about oil at all in Iraq. Tony Blair described it as an absurd conspiracy theory that oil was featuring in their thinking or their calculations. I got the minutes of 5 meetings that took place between BP and Shell and the British government in the 6 months leading up to the war, so from late 2002 to early 2003. And what they indicate is a real hunger on the part of the oil companies. One of the minutes starts with, Iraq is the underlined big oil prospect. BP are desperate to get in there. So you get this real hunger from the oil companies, and the British government, including the Trade Minister, are saying, we'll help you out, we'll make sure you get your contracts out of this, we'll make sure you're the ones who are running these oil fields once the war's out of the way.
Step 3. Invest in Parliament. There are laws in Britain which are supposed to stop the oil industry and the arms trade from buying politicians. But you can get around these by channeling money into Parliament in ways which are indirect and can't be seen.
In the House of Commons, there's a whole series of all-party discussion groups which are funded indirectly by the arms companies, because they're not supposed to fund them directly through lobbyists unless they disclose that. So what happens is that some of the arms firms have set up an organisation called the Air League, which is a sort of charitable company which funds the all-party group which discusses these matters in Parliament.
Last year, the Air League took money from Rolls-Royce, Boeing and BAE Systems.
Once you start getting money from big business, then you have to assume that there is an element in which you are going to, whether tacitly or overtly, you are going to come up with the kind of things that they want you to come up, or you won't investigate areas that they might regard as wrong to investigate.
And all party groups are just the tip of the iceberg. Inside Parliament, there are lots of other military discussion groups and committees which will help you keep the politicians in your pocket.
I've been very concerned for some time at the way the defence budget seems to be spent, not so much in the interests of the armed forces, but in the interests of a few protectionist defence companies.
Douglas Carswell is a British MP. Soon after entering Parliament, he visited Afghanistan to get some first-hand knowledge of British troops in action and to get familiar with the military equipment they use. His trip was paid for by an organisation called the Armed Forces Parliamentary Scheme. Back in the UK, Douglas did some digging and discovered that the scheme had some interesting donors.
I believe it did receive a large slice of funding at one time from a number of contractors.
And it still does. BAE Systems, Rolls-Royce and Augusta Westland invest money in the scheme every year. It's a shrewd investment. Augusta Westland have a contract to supply the Ministry of Defence with helicopters that cost £14 million each. But Carswell became concerned that this deal had been made in strange circumstances. Back in the UK, he raised his concerns in Parliament.
Defence procurement, I believe, is run in the interests of the big contractors, not our armed forces. Our armed forces pay a blood price. £1 billion contract to build helicopters was awarded for a helicopter that cost almost 50% more than the alternatives, and which would not be ready until at least 2012. At least 2012. That's a long time to wait if you're on a minefield in southern Afghanistan.
For the scheme's paymasters, Douglas Carswell was raising the wrong sorts of questions.
I can't help noticing that I was, should we say, prematurely retired from the scheme.
He who pays the piper calls the tune. But money can only get you so far. Step four, get friendly with the Prime Minister.
The whole of the British government, the Ministry of Defence, the parliamentary system and the lobbying system in Parliament all work very, very closely with the arms industry. For example, if you look at the recent trip by David Cameron to Saudi Arabia and to the Middle East in general, this was totally an integrated business and government trip.
British Aerospace is a fantastically important company in terms of arms contracts. So the government acts as its agent overseas, and that's why when the government ministers went out to Egypt, they were out there with arms people, pretending that they weren't and that they were supporting the protests in Tahrir Square.
David Cameron recently toured the Middle East and was the first world leader to visit Egypt since the revolution. He said he was out there to offer Britain's help in creating the building blocks of democracy in the region. But while he was out there, he was accused of using his Arab democracy tour as a cover for arms sales. He was travelling with arms dealers from no fewer than eight companies. The oil men were also on the tour. So before the next trade delegation, book yourself a seat on the Prime Minister's plane.
The defence industry is one of the most important industries in Britain. It is the second biggest exporter of arms in the world. And therefore, it would be amazing if it didn't have a very big influence on the government.
Step five, offer advice. A great way to peddle influence in the civil service is to plug your company into the key advisory bodies in Whitehall. The Defence Scientific Advisory Council is a good place to start. It's a forum where academics and arms industry representatives sit down and advise policymakers on defence matters. And the Defence Suppliers Forum is a place where corporate bigwigs can sit down with ministers and civil servants to iron out military industrial policy. Get your men in there to make sure decision makers are hearing the kind of opinions you need them to hear.
Corporations try and manage every sphere of society. Now, that sounds like a kind of grandiose claim, right? But they have the idea that they need to manage the political environment, they need to manage the regulatory environment, they need to manage also the environment in which their products are talked about and bought.
All these committees, task forces and working groups are vehicles for you to shape government policy. So get on board this institutionalised lobbying system and make sure you're the one calling the shots.
In every sphere which might impinge in the end on policy, the corporations are trying to dominate that. In order that, it's difficult for policymakers to reject what they want.
When you've got arms companies, when you've got a big military, and when you've got a powerful Ministry of Defence, believe me, whatever these people say, they actually are a powerful impetus towards war, because this is their rationale, this is what they are there for, and if you are producing weapons, you do at certain times want to see how they actually work out in practice. There's a huge impulse with all those things in existence to create wars.
Step six, get familiar with a new term, the revolving door.
We use the term to refer to the movement of senior politicians and officials between government and the private sector. And it's a two-way process. You have people moving from government to the private sector and from the private sector to government.
We're seeing people whose decisions, while they were ministers, top civil servants, generals, seem to be very odd, sometimes eccentric decisions. But then when they retire, they walk straight into a lobbying job. Their position in their office is often corrupted because they know that if they take a decision to choose a contract from firm A, B or C, if they know that company B is going to offer them a hacienda in Spain, a retirement job when they leave office, their decisions, their judgment in office is often influenced by their future job prospects. Many of the contracts that governments award involve billions of pounds, and the aircraft carrier decision was a £5 billion decision, and that was taken in very strange circumstances. The present government are complaining because they say it'll cost more to cancel the contract than to continue with it. And so we're going to put ourselves in an extraordinary position where we're going to have aircraft carriers, but no aircraft to put on them. And questions must be asked about how that contract was agreed. It's interesting to note that one of the ministers involved in, as a defence minister at the time, and a woman who was involved in intelligence and so on, has recently taken a job with one of the main beneficiaries of that contract, Thales. We also have a number of other ministers. A minister who is deeply involved in stopping the prosecution of BAE for possible corruption involving Arab countries is now working for BAE. This shouldn't be possible that, people will quite reasonably ask a question. Was that minister's decision influenced when they were in office by future job prospects? This is at least as serious as the expenses scandal, as a possible weakness in our democratic system, and one we have to clear up.
We do think that the revolving door is spinning out of control, because the current system that we have for regulating it is very weak and is also very opaque.
You can use this to your advantage. For example, consider getting Tony Blair on your payroll. Since leaving office, he's made a bigger fortune than any other British Prime Minister in history. Last year, he even bagged a job working for a Middle East investment fund with oil interests in Iraq. It's also worth getting in touch with a few former defence ministers. Michael Portillo was the Secretary of State for Defence from 1995 to 1997. Soon after leaving his job, he took up a directorship at BAE Systems. John Reid is a former Labour Defence Secretary. He now works for a global security company. And Jeff Hoon was Secretary of State for Defence from 1999 until 2005. He now works with Augusta Westland, the very same company with whom he approved a £1 billion helicopter contract when he was in government. But don't limit yourself to politicians. Civil servants can also come in handy.
We like to think that those we elect determine public policy. But again and again and again, when you look more closely, it's the unelected officials in Whitehall rather than elected MPs in the House of Commons who, I think, tend to have real decision-making responsibility that is of interest to big corporations. There are some big corporate interests that quite often hire senior officials from Whitehall departments and put them on their payroll. I felt so concerned about the revolving door, I made a list of all those officials who the Committee of Grandees had approved to go and work in the private sector. And I then wrote to their former departments and asked if I could see a list of any meetings they had subsequently had back at their old departments and copies of any minutes from those meetings.
The letters that Douglas got back revealed an extraordinary picture.
Senior officials, when put on the payroll of private corporate vested interests, are back in and out of their former departments faster than a revolving door in many cases.
These minutes show a meeting between three men. Sir Bill Jeffrey, the top civil servant at the Ministry of Defence, Kevin Tebbit, Jeffrey's predecessor at the MOD, who has since become the chairman of Finmeccanica UK, the parent company of Augusta Westland, and Graham Cole, the managing director of Augusta Westland itself. The minutes appear to show Tebbit threatening Jeffrey that his company will launch a hostile media campaign against the Ministry of Defence if it doesn't move things forward in the Future Lynx helicopter contract. A lovely example of the uses of the revolving door in defence. But it's much the same in oil.
Before the Iraq War, the most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, he's called the head of the diplomatic service, the five people to hold that post, the previous five before the Iraq War, of those five, four of them on leaving government service became directors of oil and gas companies, two in Shell, one in BP and one in BG. So these are the same people moving directly from the most senior role in British foreign policy to senior roles in oil and gas companies.
You have a culture which grows up of people being very close to each other in terms of ideas and thinking and a shared sense of how things should operate. The attempt to actually change minds is not really very important because all the minds have already been changed by this revolving door process where they all start to think in the same way and start to believe that the corporation's interests are the only interests worth paying attention to. It produces a kind of groupthink internally, the revolving door, but it also provides a mechanism for structural conflict of interest.
Oil interests are at the heart of British foreign policy. That comes both from the British government's own strategic agendas. It comes from a revolving door between the oil companies and the Foreign Office. And it comes from very regular contact, as we've seen from these meeting minutes, between the senior officials of the companies and of the government. The oil companies and the civil servants in the Foreign Office see themselves as almost part of the same organisation.
However, if you aren't in the arms trade, and you don't own an oil company, and if you don't think it's right that big business is running rings around our democracy, here are a few ways we could start clearing things up. First, let's introduce a statutory register of lobbyists.
The answer is for Cameron to fulfil his promise and have a compulsory register of lobbyists that will be open, will explain what their contacts are, what their interests are, who's stuffing their wallets with money, and it will end much of the damaging effects that lobbying has now.
Second, let's make things more transparent.
A statutory register on its own is not going to fix the problem. The real way of dealing with this is much simpler, much more basic. Transparency. When a minister or a senior parliamentarian meets with a particular vested interest, I think they should put details of that meeting online. If you do that, transparency and public opinion will do the rest.
Third, let's get former government officials to wait a little longer before taking up sensitive jobs in the private sector. And in special cases, let's stop the revolving door from spinning altogether.
We think that, especially in sensitive areas like defence, that maybe it is better that there should actually be a lifetime ban, such that the minister in question would not be able to take up employment in a company which may have benefited from a contract while the minister was in power. The system as it works right now is very prone to risk, and that's not good for the UK. We'll be right back.